and is a PhD candidate at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. She is a Ruth L. Kirstein Individual NRSA Pre-Doctoral Fellow at the Center for Health Equity Research and Global Women's Health, where she is mentored by nurse scientist Dr. Loretta Sweet Jamat. Her dissertation research concerns exploring the meaning of health sexuality among Black young women age 18 to 25 years old. Ms. Alexander.
So today I'm going to discuss an ethnographic research project that examined relationships between Black women and their hairstylists in the context of health promotion strategies for public health intervention scientists. And before I get started, I just wanted to say that I use the term Black women with caution. I've carefully considered, but I'd like to use that term in order to be as inclusive of women, women of African descent, instead of using the term African American. I have no disclosures. So I'll just start with by giving you a little bit of an overview of what I'm going to talk about today. Basically how I got started on this project, going to go through my theoretical framework for the analysis, as well as describing the research and the methods that I used. Then I'll go through the findings, give a little bit of discussion and some conclusions. So my initial interest in conducting research in a Black beauty salon came from a desire to understand how health promotion interventions conducted in this setting are facilitated through relationships between two primary actors, the stylist and the client. As a professional nurse, I have developed an interest in exploring how health and well-being are shaped by social group experiences, as well as institutional and structural components of society. Health intervention delivery by beauty salon stylists is an emerging public health strategy to promote wellness behaviors among Black women. And beauty salons are deemed really promising places to perform health interventions because stylists are trusted community members, clients frequently visit their stylists, and stylists understand clients' family health, family context, as well as their history. And researchers are using this strategy to address a myriad of health problems affecting Black women. So why is this setting important for understanding relationships? Public health ethnography has been used to explore discussions about health that take place in this setting. Black women and hair care practices are historically situated and meaningful. And the time and care that's involved in hair practices often requires many hours, allowing the professional stylist to manipulate a very important area of the Black female body. Many social and cultural ideals are manifest through bodies, and sociologist Ingrid Banks illuminates links between Black hair and broader sociocultural ideals of Black women. While nurse Marguerite Sandalowski theorizes the use of the body by a professional nurse as a tool to care for sick bodies. So I'd like to apply this to health and well-being practices as embodied states that can be displayed in various ways, including everyday relations. And therefore, ethnography was an ideal method for understanding relationship building during these practices. And this research is informed by two interdisciplinary theoretical frames: social capital theory and intersectionality. Social capital theory says that people are better off when they're connected to others due to the benefits that are inherent in social relationships. And that was developed by Bourdieu and Small, and furthered by Small. And then it comes with these benefits, which can range from social obligations, information sharing, services, personal reinforcement, and importantly, ties to improvements of mental health, occupational position, as well as social credentials. While intersectionality attends to how experiences at the crossroads of race, class, sexuality, and gender shape life chances and a broader consciousness of Black womanhood. So I propose to use these two theories to understand relational development in the gendered and racialized space of the Black beauty salon. Bourdieu argues that the amount of social capital that an individual possesses is directly related to the size of the networks in which one resides and an ability to mobilize them for their benefit. Additionally, the volume and the value of that capital results in strong and weak ties. Due to the constructions of the United States society today, networks and ties are largely formed along racial and class lines. While often we examine the consequences of this structure to individual and population health, in this research, I analyzed how these clusters facilitate an avenue for Black women to control health and wellness messages. So as I embarked on the research process, I noted there were several gaps in the literature. So for example, social capital theory describes outcomes from ties and networks, but fails to illuminate how relationships are formed and maintained. While health literature focuses almost exclusively on ethno-racial influences, and that's specifically between Blacks and whites, which is considered the most important determinant. Whereas I argue that we can look at gender, class, and sexuality as other areas of oppression that are less developed and can also be an influence on these relationships. So due to my interest in understanding how women manage relationships in their everyday lives, I gained entree to a beauty salon that primarily serves Black women in a large mid-Atlantic city. And the owner of the salon is an acquaintance of mine and facilitated access. I bring a personal standpoint to the study as a 37-year-old Black American woman with non-chemically manipulated hair. I have at least 20 years of experience using the services of haircare professionals, and I've been a member of the community in which I did the research for 10 years. However, I've moved from another state, and though I physically blend in, I experienced many moments of being an outsider due to my social position and unfamiliarity with some local historical references. So a little bit about the setting. Salon Jump is open 4 days per week, Wednesday through Saturday. That's a pseudonym for approximately 11 hours. It's open each day, and it sits in a leased attached row home building. And I did observations in 4 rooms of the salon, including the main grooming floor and rooms for drying and shampooing hair, as well as the waiting area. The salon is located in a busy area of the city and is racially and socioeconomically diverse. There are clusters of vacant houses and sections of blocks that are currently being gentrified. This is a popular area for small owner-operated salons that cater to Black customers, and there are approximately 10 hair care studios within 4 street blocks. So the clients and stylists represent a diverse group. 5 of the 6 stylists are men. All identify as gay or lesbian. All clients and stylists identify as Black or African American, though one stylist is identifies as Hispanic. And because these types of relationships have not been explored extensively within a population of Black women, my recruitment strategy represented a desire to remain as inclusive as possible within this racial group. Women representing different ages, social positions, and hair textures frequent this salon. This table reflects participants that I interviewed only. During the observation phase, there were many more participants than are reflected here. Interview participants ranged in age from 23 to 66. They were diverse in their educational levels and their visit frequency. Additionally, the length of the stylist-client relationship varied. So during this study, I participated as a client and received and paid for services from 3 of the 4 hair professionals in the salon. During visits, when I was not engaging in hair care practices, after obtaining verbal consent, I observed clients and stylists throughout their salon experiences in different areas. Recruitment for interview participants took place during observations, and I conducted in-depth interviews with 8 clients and 4 stylists. I analyzed field notes, memos, and transcripts for recurring themes, and interviews were conducted to thematic saturation. So I found the existence of a mutually produced and reciprocal trust that initiates and maintains relationships in this salon environment. So to enact trust in the client-style relationships, there were 4 processes that were undertaken. Negotiating boundaries, establishing professional credibility, recognizing personal vulnerabilities, and nurturing emotional bonds. And there are impersonal as well as personal elements to these relationships which act as mediators of trust by the stylist as well as the clients. So in terms of negotiating boundaries, trust turned out to be very selective. And client sharing in relationships is dependent on a perceived level of privacy. So Betty, Sydney's client, feels comforted by the anonymity afforded by the professional relationship. She says, I have a coworker. I feel like our relationship is a work relationship, so I don't think I could tell her everything that's going on with me. I don't think I would feel comfortable telling her everything because I don't have that type of trust so that I can be open and honest with her as far as if something major was going on with me. I don't think I could share everything with her. I think she maybe would tell people I wouldn't want her to tell, and I don't think she would keep it confidential. I think I have a privacy with Sydney, that it would just stay with her, and then again, it wouldn't really matter because too many people don't know me. So here, Betty feels comforted by the anonymity that's afforded by the professional relationship. She compares a relationship with her coworker to that of her stylist. So some stylist-client relationships rely on a nurturing ear of the client more than that of the stylist. Boundaries are pre-selected by the client based on the position of the personal relationship in the lives of both persons. Catherine, a 66-year-old client of Kevin's, says that their relationship is underpinned by a prior experience that where they were inhabiting the roles of student and teacher. So in this case, Catherine draws a line around those boundaries, and she draws a line around what's acceptable to discuss with Kevin, and Kevin does not. He respects those as uncrossable. So she says, oh, we don't have that type of relationship. I'm more the listener in this relationship with Kevin. But I've been with Kevin through a lot of his ups and downs. So this example demonstrates that maintaining a distance from personal topics by one person in the relationship may not influence the presence of trust. Trust in this instance takes on a personal meaning because it is rooted in a prior relationship that's regulated by boundaries. In terms of professional credibility, the quote at the top of this slide shows the importance of credible work to stylists and clients that are mutually built on trust. Nancy talks about the role of validation that Kevin is reaching the expectations she has for her personal hair care. And this is further confirmed by an interaction between Kevin and Josie, who's a young woman who I did not interview, but I observed when I was in the salon. So on a warm, sunny day, Kevin completes a short hairstyle for Josie. She told him when she sat in his chair 30 minutes earlier that she was in a hurry. Yet Kevin contorts his body by assuming a wide stance with slightly bent knees, gently arching his back so that his eyes are at the same level as her head. He then flexes his head forward so he is positioned about 8 inches from hers and peers out from raised eyebrows so as to widen his field of vision. He has a comb in one hand and uses his fingers to gently manipulate each curl. Josie impatiently says, Kevin, that's good enough. It's fine. I've got to go. Kevin exclaims, wait, girl. When you walk out that door, you're advertising for me and my salon. I need every hair to be in place. He deliberately reaches over for the curling iron to add his final touches, and Josie sits deeper in the chair, adjusts her pocketbook across her lap, and looks resigned to the fact that she will have to allow the artist to finish his craft. In terms of personal vulnerabilities, after she spent several years becoming a close friend to Madison, Gail found herself distancing herself because she values the professional relationship she has over the personal one that she shares with Madison. Their trust is built upon the relationship's purpose. She recounts that at one point she had to recognize her vulnerability of needing to get her hair done by someone she really, really trusts, which she feels is pretty difficult to find. She says, so to lose that over personal matters is not worth it to me, because then I lose my hairstylist. And sometimes stepping outside one's closest circle gives new insight and perspective to a difficult situation. In one instance, Cassandra describes her trust in Kevin as she contrasts the responses she received from her close girlfriends when revealing that she and a boyfriend of 4 years had broken up. She says, you know, my girlfriends are like, how are you? That's so horrible. He doesn't know what he's missing. Blah, 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 blah. Where Kevin, when I told him about it, he just said, well, Cassandra, you know, when one person does break it off, it's not like the other person hadn't thought about it either, which was true. It had crossed my mind. Trust is maintained through life changes by negotiating revelations of vulnerability as well. So as Cassandra discusses her concerns about Kevin's past substance abuse, She's conflicted about how best to broach the subject to support him, while keeping him in check when he appears to be thinking when using again. She confronts him with, "You don't have to tell me what's going on. I care about you, and I just hope everything's all right." And that's when he opened up to me and told me what's going on. He said, "Okay, you are like my sister, and I'm going to tell you." So he told me he had fallen off, and he had been struggling. So this demonstrates how the client is using the how the stylist is using the client in terms of a relational bond. So now we go to nurturing emotional bonds. And Madison describes a relationship with his client, which he counts as one of his closest, though he sees her only twice a year, because her financial situation no longer allows her to get professional hairstyles as often. He says, "We have a lot in common. I mean, she's from this state, I'm from this state, she has Puerto Rican in her, I'm Puerto Rican. She's also intrigued by me. She loves my style. We always have that connection of being able to talk about anything. It was quick for us to make that connection past me just doing her hair." Meanwhile, Patrice, another stylist, discusses how important maintaining her relationship with her clients are. "I don't just call you because you haven't had your hair done. If you've told me that your child was sick last week, I'll call you the following week to see how she's doing. Because your clients do become part of your family, and I just try my best to stay in contact with them, and always seek to try to improve their look and the health of their hair." So reciprocal commitments by stylists and clients nurture trust in the beauty salon, which facilitates an environment for health information delivery. This study informs public health practice because it reveals the multidimensionality of trust when promoting well-being among black women. Practitioners aiming to understand trust building in black communities can develop and test health promotion preventions in varied environments. However, scientists may wish to re-examine their dependence on the roles and expectations that we've ascribed to these relations. So most of the health promotion interventions that are currently being done are relying on an assumption that of expert being the stylist, amateur being the client. So it's a unidirectional mechanism for health information delivery, where this study illuminates how that could be bidirectional. Interventions may be limited also by some of the relational strategies that are employed by clients and stylists. So not everyone has this trusting relationship. Some of the relationships are more impersonal and may not facilitate health information delivery, where others are incredibly personal and they may be able to reach that point where we could see health behavior changes as a result of the intervention. So in conclusion, while there are noted variations in the way trust takes shape in these relationships, trust is involved in all processes. Some examples are more revealing than others, but the trust process is more reciprocal and mutual than has been previously recognized. Further examination of personal relations during self-care and health promotion activities for black women are truly imperative, and studying these relationships may have further implications for understanding how the professional-client interactions can foster health and well-being. These are my references, and thank you for your questions at the end of the session.